11 hours, Greenwich Mean Time. This is Newsdesk in the World Service of the BBC with Marion Marshall. The headlines. As forces loyal to Laurent Kabila strengthen their military hold in the Zairean capital, Kinshasa, his senior aides are attempting to mobilize political support in the city. Hundreds of thousands of people have been evacuated from the coastal region of Bangladesh to escape from a powerful cyclone which is sweeping in from the Bay of Bengal. The former communist opposition has won a decisive victory in Mongolia's presidential election in what's being seen as a setback for a market reform program. The first direct train from Beijing has arrived in Hong Kong 6 weeks before the British colony reverts to Chinese control. Also in the program, the United Nations has appealed for international assistance after a new report highlights serious food shortages in the Great Lakes region of Central Africa. Troops of the new Zairean leadership of Laurent Kabila are continuing their efforts to establish full control of the capital, Kinshasa. Thousands of soldiers are now spread across the city and have taken command of more strategic installations. They've been trying to reassure citizens of their safety following an orgy of killing after their arrival on Saturday. More than 200 people, mostly former government soldiers, were burned or hacked to death by civilians. Today, officials of the new leadership began outlining their political program, as our correspondent in Kinshasa, Richard Downes, reports.
It was short on detail, but the political program of the alliance forces has the unmistakable mark of the new wave of African political thinking stamped all over it. A number of senior members of the alliance told a news conference that their government would derive its authority from the bottom up. The first person to be invited to the Constituent Assembly, which will draw up a constitution for the Democratic Republic of Congo, will be a peasant, a lowly villager. This will symbolize that power in this reborn country will derive from village-level democracy. Asked about whether the alliance would allow other political parties to operate, a spokesman sidestepped the question and said that anyone with ideas should come first to the alliance. The delegation avoided a direct answer to the question of where other political leaders, such as the popular figure of Etienne Tshisekedi, would fit into the new government. Meanwhile, in the centre of Kinshasa, a demonstration of students and others marched on the French embassy to protest against French policy here. France is widely believed to have supported the old Mobutu regime, and a guard at the embassy narrow escaped being lynched by the crowd. Students have built a mock monument to President Mobutu, made from old Zairean banknotes. At the front of the sculpture, the figure 666 is carved out, signifying the students' belief that the old president personified everything that is evil in this country.
Richard Downes in Kinshasa. A number of countries have followed South Africa in recognizing Laurent Kabila as the new Zairean head of state or congratulating him on his takeover. They include Rwanda, Burundi, Angola, Kenya, Tanzania, Libya, Iran, and Japan. The United States and other Western governments have urged him to form a broad-based transitional government. Our diplomatic correspondent Barnaby Mason joins me now in the studio with a report on the difficulties facing the new leader and the effect outside Zaire of the fall of President Mobutu.
Western governments welcome the relatively low level of violence during the rebel army's takeover of Kinshasa. But they're concerned about Laurent Kabila's past as a Marxist guerrilla leader, the mixed record of his forces in other parts of Zaire they've captured, and the reported atrocities against Rwandan Hutu refugees. Western officials wonder about Mr. Kabila's ability to hold together his unwieldy coalition of regional, ethnic and political interests. Is he just an opportunist, or does he combine authoritarian political instincts with a more recent conversion to the benefits of private enterprise in the economy? One of Mr. Kabila's main backers and possible role models, President Museveni of Uganda, has held elections but has not allowed party political activities. Uganda is among the countries which backed the winner in the Zaire civil war. Another is Rwanda, which has thus succeeded in removing the threat across the border from its former Hutu rulers. The Angolan government benefits from the cutting off of any further military help to the former rebel movement UNITA from Zaire. South Africa, although it failed to bring about an organised transition, gains some credit for having tried. Outside Africa, the biggest loser from the fall of President Mobutu is clearly France, though the French Foreign Minister, Hervé de Charette, denied that things should be seen in that light. A decline in the use of the French language in Zaire looks likely. The The United States ended its support for the old regime some years ago and is likely to increase its influence in Africa as a result, despite its doubts about Mr. Kabila.
Our diplomatic correspondent, Barnaby Mason. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization has appealed for international assistance to tackle what it says are serious food shortages in the Great Lakes region of Central Africa. In a new report, the FAO also blames the deteriorating security situation in Rwanda and neighboring Burundi for what it says are precarious food supplies there. And the FAO calls for urgent action to help starving Rwandan refugees in eastern Zaire. Jane Stanley from Nairobi has more details.
The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization says that despite good harvests in several parts of the continent, 17 sub-Saharan African countries are facing food shortages and emergencies. Armed conflict, pests and harsh weather are the main causes, meaning that countries like Liberia and Sierra Leone in West Africa and Somalia and Sudan in the east all need substantial international assistance. Severe drought and floods have, the FAO says, left 3 million people in Kenya and Tanzania and their border areas with neighboring countries facing particularly desperate problems. But it's the Great Lakes region of Central Africa which prompts most concern. The Food and Agriculture Organization says everything possible must be done by donor nations to alleviate the extreme suffering of Rwandan refugees in eastern Zaire. Tens of thousands are seriously malnourished and are in very poor health. Though hundreds of refugees are being repatriated every day by the UN's mass airlift from the Zairean city of Kisangani, the FAO says that increasing insecurity in Rwanda has made the supply of food for the refugees when they're back home increasingly precarious.
Jane Stanley. You're listening to News Desk in the BBC World Service. A powerful cyclone is heading towards Bangladesh's second largest city of Chittagong after hitting coastal areas in the south of the country. The weather office says the path of the cyclone has become extremely difficult to predict, but it's expected to hit Chittagong in the evening, local time. Winds of up to 180 kilometres per hour are battering the worst affected region around Tek Naf. As Francis Harrison reports from the capital, Dhaka, the authorities have evacuated hundreds of thousands of people thought to be most at risk.
The fact that officials say the cyclone is now heading towards the country's second largest city is worrying. Earlier it had appeared the cyclone would miss the densely populated port city, but even now it's difficult to predict its movement. The authorities in Dhaka say they've lost contact with some of the worst hit areas around the town of Tek Naf on the southern peninsula bordering Burma. Already there are reports that the country's only coral island, an unspoilt tropical paradise, has been submerged. Officials say the island's 6,000 inhabitants were amongst hundreds of thousands of people evacuated from the region. People from low-lying coastal areas have been moved to safety, many of them in specially built cyclone shelters that can house up to 2,000 people each. Scientists say 17% of the world's cyclones occur in the Bay of Bengal. The worst cyclone in Bangladeshi history occurred in the same area in 1991, killing about 140,000 people.
Francis Harrison in Dhaka. The Indian Prime Minister I.K. Gujral today begins a five-day visit to the northeast of the country, regarded as one of the most troubled regions of India because of long-standing tribal and ethnic tensions. Some regional and political groups have called strikes to coincide with the Prime Minister's visit. But the strongest group in the region, the outlawed Nationalist Socialist Council of Nagaland, has not joined the strike call. It has said it's willing to continue the peace talks begun by Mr. Gujral's predecessor, H.D. Devi Goda. From Delhi, here's Daniel Lack.
This is I.K. Gujral's first trip to the northeast of India since becoming Prime Minister last month. He's to go to six of the region's states, including the most troubled. The man he replaced, H.D. Devi Goda, also visited the northeast in his 10 months in office and announced major development projects worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Previous governments have made attempts to stabilize the northeast, but now there are parallel streams of diplomatic and military activity aimed at resolving at least some of the conflicts. Mr. Devi Goda confirmed in Parliament before leaving office earlier this year that he himself had met the leader of a key insurgent group from the state of Nagaland while both were in another country. Mr. Gujral's visit will be more for symbolism than substance, but it will send an additional signal that long-neglected ethnic fault lines are very much on official minds in Delhi. Strikes have been called by militant groups in some of the areas he is to visit. A major problem in the northeast is the objection by indigenous people to the presence of settlers from the rest of India, mainly ethnic Bengalis. In some places, settlers outnumber locals. The insurgencies range from anti-settler movements to groups fighting for outright independence.
Daniel Lack in Delhi. In presidential elections in Mongolia, the former communists have defeated the governing Democrats in what's being seen as a widespread rejection of the government's stringent economic reform program. Officials said the opposition candidate, Natsag Bagabandi, had achieved an outright victory by attracting nearly two-thirds of the vote. From the Mongolian capital, Ulaanbaatar, here's Humphrey Hawksley.
Mongolia's new president will be the young and charismatic leader of the Mongolian People's Revolutionary Party, Natsag Bagabandi, who presently heads the parliamentary opposition. As results came in through the night from around this vast, landlocked country, it became clear that the incumbent president, Orchibat, would be swept from office immediately, and there would be no need for a second runoff election for the winner to get a clear majority. President Orchibat only commanded support from about a third of the voters. An ultra-nationalist candidate got less than 10%, and Mr. Bagabandi the rest. The issue was not the Western-style democratic system, that stays, but the free market economic reforms will now slow down. While praised by the International Monetary Fund and other institutions, they've caused mass unemployment, leading to crime, broken families, and alcoholism. Mr. Bagabandi has the power to veto parliamentary legislation and send the tough economic packages now going through back to be watered down. He says he wants a safety net for the poor.
Humphrey Hawksley. The first direct train from Beijing to Hong Kong has arrived in the British colony some 6 weeks before it's due to return to Chinese control. Chinese officials described the inauguration of the direct link as an historic moment, which would draw China and Hong Kong closer together. Matt Fry watched the train's arrival.
Train 993 from Beijing rolled into Kowloon Station after 30 hours and 2 minutes, precisely 7.5 minutes late according to the schedule, about a century late according to history. Direct train links between the mainland and Hong Kong, which became a British colony before the age of the railway, have never existed. The fact that they've been established now is above all a patriotic milestone. On the 1st of July, the day of the handover, China will have one country and one train system. The 400 or so passengers, some of them VIPs, many of them ordinary people, were greeted by dragon dancers, brass bands and speeches at just about every station along the 1,500-mile journey. Despite its historic importance, the trip was cheap. A seat in hard class costs as little as £15. Soft class berths are about £90. And the service is impeccable. Train conductors have to speak Mandarin, Cantonese and English. And today they had to wear huge red sashes. The train was hailed by the head of the Hong Kong company that built the track as a very efficient mode of mass travel. But since Hong Kong's gates will remain closed to the vast majority of Chinese citizens after the handover, the travelling masses may be somewhat limited.
Matt Fry in Hong Kong. A report from South Korea says China has agreed in principle to take part in proposed four-way talks on the future of the divided Korean peninsula. The South Korean news agency said China's foreign minister, Chien Chi-chun, told his South Korean counterpart, Yu Chong-ha, of the decision during a meeting. It said Mr. Yu, who's on a three-day official visit to China, had asked for more active participation from Beijing on the issue. Prosecution lawyers in South Korea have demanded a 20-year prison sentence for the founder of the Hanbo Steel Group, Chung Tae-soo. Prosecutors have also recommended jail terms for 10 other people caught up in the Hanbo loan scandal, which exposed high-level government corruption. Among them are the founder's son and group chairman, Chung Bo-kun. From Seoul, our correspondent Charles Scanlon sent this report.
With the South Korean government seemingly paralyzed by scandal, state prosecutors have seized the initiative in the battle against official corruption. They're demanding tough prison sentences against the 11 politicians, businessmen and bankers implicated in the Hanbo loan scandal. They're calling for a 20-year jail term for the founder of Hanbo, Chung Tae-soo, whose steel company collapsed in January with debts of $6 billion. Hanbo was revealed to be at the center of a web of corruption linking government and big business. A former deputy director of South Korea's spy agency is the latest in a series of influential figures to be arrested. He was a close crony of President Kim Il-sung's son, Kim Hyun-chol, who was arrested on Saturday on charges of influence peddling. remains unclear how much further the investigation will be allowed to go. South Korean prosecutors have no tradition of independence from political control, and they'll be reluctant to press their inquiries too close to the president himself. With the arrest of his son, President Kim is hoping to put the scandal behind him and regain some of his political influence. But that may amount to little more than wishful thinking. He's yet to explain how much he knew about the corruption at the heart of his administration and how he funded his own lavish election campaign in 1992.
Charles Scanlon in Seoul. Japan's trade surplus is on the rise again. In April, it surged by 163%. With the details and the rest of the financial news, here's Sally Hardcastle.
Japan's trade surplus more than doubled in April compared with the same time last year. A weaker yen plus increased demand for Japanese-made cars and machinery brought the surplus to $7.2 billion. The increase of over 160% was the largest for 5 years. And it is likely to renew tensions in trade relations between the United States and Japan. The surplus with the US shot up over 170%, largely because Americans keep on buying more Japanese cars. The US has been urging Japan not to rely on exports to fuel its domestic recovery, but today Japan's finance ministry said the trade gap with the rest of the world would widen while domestic demand remained weak. Now the latest from the financial markets. London's 100 share index is down 30 points at 46.63. In Tokyo, the Nikkei average rose 165 points to 20,489. On the foreign exchanges, the dollar is at 1 German mark 70 and 116 Japanese yen. The pound is worth $1.63.9. And that's the financial news.
With Sally Hardcastle. You're listening to News Desk. Later in the programme, a report from Brazil on a hostage crisis in one of the country's many overcrowded prisons. First, a reminder of our top story. As forces loyal to Laurent Kabila strengthen their military hold on the Zairean capital, Kinshasa, his senior aides have been explaining the new government's political programme. They told journalists that their government would derive its authority from what they called village-level democracy. They said an assembly would be set up in the coming months, which would be charged with drawing up a detailed constitution. The United Nations Secretary-General Kofi Annan has arrived in Vienna to make a far-reaching review of the UN's many operations in the city. About 4,000 people work in Vienna for the UN and its agencies, such as the Industrial Development Organization, UNIDO. John Devitt reports.
The general review of efficiency forced mainly by the United States is likely to have a significant impact in Vienna. As elsewhere, it's considered that the work done by some agencies overlap and that in general bureaucratic fat should be trimmed. UNIDO, which has a staff of 800, is at the center of that review. Already, the United States has withdrawn its financial support and, as one diplomat put it, unless UNIDO changes, it will cease to exist. One suggestion is that it should be merged into other agencies. During his four-day visit, Mr. Annan will also meet senior Austrian politicians. Austria has a sort of love-hate relationship with the UN. The country went out of its way to attract the organization here nearly 20 years ago. During the Cold War, the presence of the UN was seen as an important security guarantee. The organization's impressive headquarters on the banks of the Danube are provided at a peppercorn rent. But the security argument is no longer so important, and the residents of Vienna have long been critical of the way UN employees have pushed up property prices in the city. Even so, the UN provides employment, and there are reports that Austria would like to attract a new body, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization, which is expected to be formed later this year.
That report was from John Devitt in Vienna. Two leaders of the political wing of the IRA, Sinn Féin, elected to the British Parliament earlier this month, have gone to the House of Commons to challenge a ruling banning them from using offices there. Sinn Féin's president, Gerry Adams, and its chief negotiator, Martin McGuinness, were discussing the ban with parliamentary officials. They will not be allowed to use the facilities in Parliament unless they take the oath of allegiance to the Queen. The two Sinn Féin MPs refused to do so. Here's our political reporter, Adam Brimelow.
Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness arrived at Westminster determined to assert what they say is their right to use MPs' facilities at Westminster. Last week, the Speaker of the House of Commons made a ruling denying them access because of their refusal to take an oath of allegiance to the Queen, a formality every MP has to go through at the start of a new Parliament. The Sinn Féin president, Gerry Adams, said the ban on Sinn Féin breached British constitutional law. He called it an act of arrogance, which discriminated against them and everyone who had voted for them. He and Mr. McGuinness may try to exploit what they see as a loophole in the Speaker's ruling, which would allow them access to members' areas until tomorrow night, when the debate on the government's legislative proposals, the Queen's speech, is concluded. The protest is threatening to delay a planned meeting between Sinn Féin representatives and government officials following an initiative by the new Prime Minister, Tony Blair, to revive the stalled peace process. In a separate development, hopes are growing of a breakthrough in efforts to forestall disturbances at the traditional parades, which have often led to violence in recent years.
A political reporter, Adam Brimelow. Transcripts of Nazi radio messages detailing the massacre of thousands of Soviet Jews are to be released in Britain today. The messages were decoded during the Second World War by Britain's main code-breaking station. They will reopen the debate about how much Allied leaders knew about the early stages of the Holocaust. The papers are reported to show that German police began systematically murdering Jews as early as June 1941, much earlier than previously thought. Some of the documents were declassified by the United States last year, and Holocaust researchers believe they prove that the number of Jews killed by the Nazis was 7 million and not 6 million. The United States Defense Department is about to publish what's described as a far-reaching review of defense policy. The document, entitled the Quadrennial Defense Review, is intended to shape United States strategic thinking into the early years of the next century. However, as our defense correspondent Jonathan Marcus reports, critics in Washington are already complaining that a great opportunity for reform has been missed.
The United States saw itself as the arsenal of the free world during the Cold War. And if the underlying assumptions of the Quadrennial Defense Review are anything to go by, it still sees itself as having a global military role, even though the Cold War is now over. Much of the debate has focused on the need to maintain America's military superiority while trying to shrink the annual Pentagon budget of some $250 billion. Even today, the United States maintains an army of some 500,000 regular troops and a navy with 12 aircraft carriers. The benchmark for US military power is the perceived need to be able to fight two regional wars almost at the same time, a benchmark that the Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, is unlikely to alter. He is expected to propose a cutback of some 60,000 military personnel, along with the elimination of some naval and air force units. In addition, orders for costly advanced warplanes like the F-22 will be scaled down. Secretary Cohen took office when this full-scale review of American defense policy was already well underway. Nonetheless, it provides him with his first opportunity to leave his mark on U.S. strategic thinking, and he has gone for a cautious approach. Too cautious, say many of his critics, who argue that greater cutbacks should have been made in order to finance the high-tech information-based systems on which many people believe the United States' future military advantage will depend.
Jonathan Marcus. The personal belongings of Pamela Harriman, the British-born socialite and former American ambassador to France, are to be auctioned later today, 4 months after her death. More than 1,000 items from her various houses are to be sold by Sotheby's in New York, including pictures and mementos of her father-in-law, Britain's Prime Minister during the Second World War, Winston Churchill. Sotheby's expects to raise around $4 million from the auction, which will go to Mrs. Harriman's son and his estranged wife. Police in Brazil have surrounded a prison in the state of Sao Paulo, where inmates are holding nearly 400 people hostage. It's not clear how many of the 700 prisoners at the São Vicente jail are taking part in the revolt, or what demands they're making. Our correspondent in Sao Paulo is Robert Plummer.
The rebellion at the maximum security jail began on Sunday afternoon during visiting hours. A group of inmates seized control of the jail, taking six prison guards and about 500 visitors hostage. It's not yet known what kind of weapons the inmates used to overpower the guards. The director of the São Vicente prison, Mauricio Guarnieri, later negotiated the release of 110 women and children, but the situation remains tense. The mutiny is the latest in a recent series of jail uprisings in Brazil, but even at the best of times, incidents of this kind are alarmingly frequent. On average, there are three jail riots a month in Brazil, the inevitable consequence of serious overcrowding in the majority of prisons. Police are continuing to stand guard outside the San Vicente jail in an effort to prevent the uprising from spreading to another prison just 100 metres away, which holds a further 200 inmates.
Robert Plummer. You're listening to News Desk in the BBC World Service. It's now 11:25, Greenwich Mean Time. British scientists say that a new supercomputer, Cosmos, should enable them to discover how the universe began and to predict how and when it may end. Professor Stephen Hawking is leading the team of scientists launching the $3 million supercomputer at Cambridge University. Scientific theories about the origins of the universe and its development will be fed into the computer, which will then calculate how the universe ought to look today. If these calculations match maps of the universe as it is now, scientists say the theory fed into Cosmos will be proven correct. Two of Australia's leading football clubs could be expelled from the National League after violence between ethnic Greek and Croat fans. That story and the rest of the sports news from Steve Tung.
Football in Australia has traditionally had a strong ethnic base, which the soccer authorities have tried to play down. Last year, they forced three clubs to scrap logos reflecting their European roots. Now drastic action could be taken after clashes between fans from Sydney United, traditionally of Croatian origin, and South Melbourne, whose followers from the Greek community had taunted them by waving a Serbian flag. Police had tried to stop the Sydney fans, who are traditionally of Croatian origin, celebrating a goal by lighting illegal flares. Two officers sent into the crowd were attacked before rival supporters invaded the pitch. Dave Hill, head of the governing body Soccer Australia, is promising tough action against the two clubs.
There's no place in modern Australia for what we all witnessed at Parramatta yesterday, and there's certainly no place for it in Australian soccer. And we're absolutely resolute. It won't happen again. And anybody that delivers that to soccer will be out.
Manchester United may have to break the world transfer record if they want the Brazilian midfielder Juninho as replacement for Frenchman Eric Cantona, who's announced his retirement. Reports say that Middlesbrough will demand a fee of close to $24 million for him. Another Frenchman, Olivier de Kersauson, has broken the record for sailing non-stop round the world. He and his crew completed the voyage in just under 72 days. That beat by 3 days the previous best, achieved by New Zealander Peter Blake in 1994. The trimaran Sportelec had set off on March the 8th on his sixth attempt to break a world record. Finally, golf. The American Tiger Woods has won his first tournament since the US Masters. He took the Byron Nelson Classic in Texas by two strokes.
Steve Tung. An Australian donkey named Murphy has been posthumously awarded for bravery during the World War I battle at Gallipoli. In a ceremony conducted by the Australian Deputy Prime Minister Tim Fisher, the donkey was awarded the Purple Cross, 82 years after he played an heroic role in transporting wounded soldiers to safety under Turkish fire. Mr. Fisher described it as one of the great feats of World War I. Now, to end the programme, we'll have a look at the main points in the world news. As troops of the Zairean rebel leader Laurent Kabila strengthen their control over the capital, Kinshasa, his senior aides have been explaining the new government's political program. They said it would derive its authority from village-level democracy. Officials in Bangladesh say that a powerful cyclone, which has hit the southeast coast, is now heading for the port of Chittagong, the country's second-largest city. At least 300,000 people have been evacuated from coastal areas. The candidate of the former communist opposition in Mongolia has won a sweeping victory in the country's presidential elections. Natsak Bagabandi campaigned against the government's stringent economic reform program. The first direct train from Beijing to Hong Kong has arrived in the British colony, some 6 weeks before its territory is handed over to Chinese control. Chinese officials described the inauguration of the direct link as an historic moment, which would draw Beijing and Hong Kong closer together. And that's the end of News Desk.